So I'm really happy to be here now to talk about something related to my research area, so quantum gravity. And I really think that Waterloo is a really amazing place to talk about, to learn about quantum gravity, because we really have a big group here with Bianca, Laurent, and Lee at PI, and Florian at University of Waterloo. And there are also many postdoc, PhD students, and visitors. So it's really a dynamic topic and many opportunities to talk with people. So let me just introduce you that Florian, who is here, is going to be your TA, and is doing his PhD with Laurent Frelen. Okay? So all these people are working mainly on loop quantum gravity, spin foam model, non-commutative geometry, and other related topics. But so during this lecture, so I'm going to focus mainly on the loop quantum gravity approach and talk a bit about the spin foam model. And I'm also really excited because you will have several guest lecturers coming here. For example, today we even have Beatrice, so she's postdoc here, and she's going to talk about loop quantum cosmology. But Laurent is also going to come at some point, Bianca, and some other postdocs, okay? So what I'm going to do is mainly focus on 3D gravity, Euclidean gravity with no cosmological constants, and then try to build a theory of loop quantum gravity. So I think that then it's going to show you that what are the methods we can use, and hopefully you're going to learn how to quantize gravity on this toy model, 3D gravity. And then, of course, I will mention what are the difficulties when you go to the 4D case. And all these people coming from to give some guest lecture will talk more about their research topics. Okay, so you will have both kind of idea. So today I've chosen to give a non-technical lecture. So I know that you like technical stuff, equation on the blackboard. So don't worry, we're going to start with that as soon as tomorrow. But for today, I just want to take the time to try to motivate why we are interested in quantum gravity, what would be a theory of quantum gravity, why quantum gravity. And so the first thing I can say is that you should all know that one main issue with quantum gravity is that we don't have any calls from experimentally accessible situations where we would need to quantize gravity for their description. Okay? And so, for example, if you just look at the ratio of the gravitational force between a proton and an electron and the electromagnetic force between a proton and an electron, you can see that the gravitational force is 10 to the power minus 40 weaker than the gravitational electric force. So you see that, indeed, it seems that there is no experimental needs to have a theory of quantum gravity, at least to do something in a lab, of course. And the fact that we don't have any experimental guidance is one of the difficulties of quantum gravity, because this means that we try to build the theory without any guidance here, okay? And as I said, so also during this lecture, what I'm going to try to give you is a kind of big picture of what we have in loop quantum gravity, what is the picture of the theory we have today, briefly with. Okay, so let's start by what we know, at least what you're supposed to know. So you know about quantum mechanics, which is used to describe the dynamics of any system. Then you should know about the standard model of particle physics, which is going to describe all matter that had been observed directly up to so far with its non-gravitational interaction. And then, of course, we have general relativity, which is about gravity, space, and time. And all this theory have been experimentally verified very well. And so, for example, in 2012, you know that the Higgs boson was observed as predicted by the standard model. So in some way, this was really a great news, but in other way, it was not. This also means that we don't have here any new physics. So again, we don't have any experimental guidance to tell us where we could go with the theory of quantum gravity. And 2 years ago, just 100 years after the prediction by general relativity, gravitational waves were observed for the first time. So again, general relativity is very well checked, verified experimentally. And again, we don't have here any guidance. But you all know that this is not, anyway, the final story about the elementary world. And just to mention a few open problems, let's mention dark matter, where you know that experimentally 85% of the galactic and cosmological matter is likely not to be of the kind described by the standard model. Then another point would be the issue of unification. So what do I mean here? You know that so the standard model is going to describe the strong force, electromagnetic, and weak force. And the idea would be, can we have a common framework to describe also the gravitational force? So this is a bit the idea, at least the motivation, followed by string theory. But in the loop quantum gravity approach, in fact, we consider that quantum gravity can really be is an open problem and can be can be studied on its own, okay, without any relation to the two others. So this is, of course, an assumption. Some people are going to tell you that we need some theory of modified gravity. Others are going to say that you really need to consider all forces to have a theory of gravity. So this is not the assumption I'm going to take. So up to now, I'm just going to focus on the issue of quantum gravity, and I'm not going to mention these two other issues here, okay? So I'm really going to... and so in the approach followed by loop quantum gravity to build a theory of quantum gravity, we start from the idea that gravity is a property of space-time. So first, what do we know on... on space-time. So now, yeah, first, so a theory of quantum gravity, what we want to do is to try to more or less put together these two theory. And again, so we want to focus on the property of space-time. So what do we know about space-time? this is the Einstein-Hilbert action. Describing, so if you look at now the equation of motion, of course, you're going to get the Einstein equation, and this is written in terms of the metric variable, okay? So this is general relativity, which is a theory of the gravitational field. But so what is really new is that all physics that you, except general relativity that you're studying, are going to be, you're going to study fields or particles on a classical space-time, okay? So your fields and particles are living on space-time. So what is really Einstein's discovery is telling us is that the gravitational field, so the metric, is space-time itself. So what does it mean? What we want to do a theory of quantum gravity, this means that we want to quantize a field which is not living on space-time, but which is space-time itself. So you see that this is completely different from what we are used to in what you are used to in quantum field theory. Okay, and this lack of background structure technically translate into the fact that here you will have diffeomorphism invariant. Okay, so we're going to come back on that. So another important ingredient from general relativity that we can want to keep in mind is that geometry is a manifestation of the gravitational field. Okay, so what is geometry? Geometry is going to deal with quantities such as area, volume, the length, and angles, and this all these quantities are determined by the gravitational field. So what does it mean that we want a theory of quantum gravity? Here, this means that we want a theory of quantum geometry, okay? So what we're going to come back on this notion. Okay, so these are mainly the two lessons that we want to have in mind when we want to build the theory of quantum gravity. The first is that, so space-time, the gravitational field is space-time, and we want to quantize geometry. So now let's move to quantum mechanics. So contrary to GR, which is often said that GR is Einstein's theory, quantum gravity is quantum mechanics is really the work by many people. Most of them are on this picture. So this picture is a picture taken at the Solvay conference in 1927. And so just a few sentences on this conference, this picture is quite amazing. So here you have 29 physicists, I think, and you have 17 Nobel Prizes. So I don't know if you will never attend such a conference with so many Nobel Prizes. This is quite an amazing ratio. But the other ratio, which is not so amazing here, is that we have only one woman. I don't know if you can see. You know who is here? So she is here. you know, with you. So, but it's, so it's Marie Curie. But I also think that it's the only one in this picture who has two Nobel Prizes. So and so. So not so bad, but yeah, still only one. Okay, so this was just about quantum mechanics, but let's, what do we know from quantum mechanics? So let's just start with the very, the simplest system that we can have, so the hydrogen atom. So you know that classically it's going to be described by the Coulomb force. And the issue with the classical description is that the classical description is going to tell you that the hydrogen atom is unstable. Whereas you know from observation in nature that this is not the case. And so this is cured by the quantum description, where in the quantum description now you have some level of energy. Okay, so energy is quantized. And in particular, you have a minimum level of energy. So this means that now the electron cannot go onto the proton anymore. And really, we can interpret this quantum effect as a repulsive force. Okay, and I think maybe Beatrice is going to mention that again in the loop quantum gravity, loop quantum cosmology framework. Thanks. where really you can interpret quantum effect as acting as a repulsive force. Okay, so what are we trying to do now? As I said, we want to put general relativity and quantum mechanics together. So what does it mean? So from quantum mechanics, we know that now any dynamical quantity has to be quantized. So what is the picture we get from quantum mechanics is that the world is formed by discrete quanta jumping over a flat spacetime. And from GR, we have that spacetime is curved, everything is smooth and deterministic. So if you take these two pictures, you're like, wow, how can I put that together? Everything seems very different. You have the description of two different worlds. And of course, this is one of the main difficulties of quantum gravity, that you're dealing with two theories which are really drastically different and conceptually different. So, so this is to motivate why, in some sense, quantum gravity is so difficult. And but also now, where are we expecting to get some quantum gravity effect? So you should have heard about the notion of Planck scale. So as you can see, the Planck scale is very, very small. So how can we get the Planck scale? So we think that quantum gravity effects are going to happen at this scale. So from quantum mechanics, we have this notion of quantum wavelengths, which is a fundamental characteristic of a particle. But these quantum wavelengths can also be interpreted as the minimum resolution that we get. Because indeed, so if you try to measure the size of a particle, because of the you have the uncertainty principle, then you're going to end up with a minimum resolution that you can get. And this is going this minimum resolution is given by this quantum wavelengths. Okay, so you see that from quantum mechanics, you have the kind of notion of a minimum length. Now, what do we get from general relativity? So in general relativity, you all heard about this Schwarzschild radius, which is that, so if you try to concentrate some matter under a in a region of radius less than this Schwarzschild radius, then you get a black hole. So let's see if we now equal these two quantity, then you can solve that and you're going to end up with what we call the Planck mass. And then this is going to give you the notion of Planck length. But so you see that here, the Planck length is going to happen when we, from quantum mechanics, when we have something very, very small, and from GR when we have something very, very dense. So in which situation do we have something which is very dense and very small? So just from GR, you know that inside the black hole, you have a singularity. I'm going to come back on that later, but also we also think that the Big Bang, the origin of the universe starts with a Big Bang singularity. And a singularity generically is associated with a divergence in quantities that indicate that then the theory has been pushed beyond its realm of application. And so the idea is that if we have a theory of quantum gravity, then the expectation is that the theory will offer a new perspective on this notion of singularity and maybe eliminate this singularity. And so I'm not going to tell you more about that now, but Beatrice is going to tell you about, yeah, what it, that indeed in the context of loop quantum cosmology, the Big Bang's singularity is in fact resolved, and we are now talking about a big bounce. Okay. So this is really the idea where we need to have a theory of quantum gravity, and that this singularity could theory of quantum gravity, and that this singularity could be resolved in this context. So now I've been talking about the fact that we want to quantize gravity. And so what does it mean to quantize something? Which kind of quantization procedure do we have? So if we start again from this very simple system, the hydrogen atom. So if classically you have, you know that it's described in terms of this electrostatic Coulomb force, how do you get to the quantum description? Where here you have this discretized level of energy. So for this simple system, you can apply the Dirac program. Okay, so I'm going to come back a lot on that because in fact it's what we're going to use in the context of loop quantum gravity. So the Dirac procedure is a canonical approach. So this means that you're going to do first a canonical analysis of your problem. So a canonical analysis means that you're going to split space. So if you're in 4D, you're going to do a first splitting of space-time and then do the Hamiltonian analysis of your theory, and then you can apply the Dirac program. But, so I'm going to come back on that, but you see that here, indeed now, you will have to deal with your observable are going to be at the quantum level, are going to be operators. So we're here with the Hamiltonian. So now let's move to a bit more complicated system, the electromagnetic force. So you know that we have a quantum version of this, which gives you the quantum electrodynamics. How can we go from here to here? Can we use, again, the Dirac procedure? And the answer is not really. And so what has been done is that, in fact, it's already a system which is quite complicated. And we need to go to the perturbative, use the perturbative approach. So this was proposed by Feynman, where you're all familiar with that now. You use kind of Feynman diagrams, and you end up with a theory of quantum electrodynamics. We can do that for the three forces, and then you will get what we the standard model. So can we do the same with gravity? What should I put here to get to quantum gravity? So let's first try by the perturbative approach. So what does it mean to use a perturbative approach in the context of quantum gravity? This means that now your metric is going to be, you look at your metric as the flat metric, which is fixed, plus some small perturbation around this flat metric. So is this can work? And the answer is, so this is the first naive approach. And the answer is no, it doesn't work. Okay, and it has been shown that this is not working. So you have divergences here that, which means that this theory is not renormalizable. So at this stage, we have two options. Either we try to cure this perturbative approach in some way, which is more or less the idea behind string theory, where, of course, you have additional ingredients. It's not now you're dealing with strings. You have additional dimension. You have additional particles, the supersymmetric particles. But I'm not going to give more details about that. You had a really great lecture by Davide on that a few weeks ago. So what is the other option? And it's the option that we are using in the loop quantum gravity approach is to go back to Dirac's approach and to use a canonical quantization. So this is really what we're going to do in the loop quantum gravity framework. We're really going to start from taking seriously the lessons we get from general relativity, meaning that we have a theory with a background independence. The gravitational field, the metric is the gravitational field that we want to quantize, and then apply some Dirac method. Okay, and then can we get a theory of quantum gravity? So this is what we're trying to get here. So let me just give you a first picture about loop quantum gravity. What is so you need to start with an action. So the first action you know is the Einstein-Hilbert action written in terms of the metric. Then if you apply the canonical analysis on that, you're going to end up with what is called the ADM formulation. Okay, so you're going to do a 3+1 splitting of space-time. Then you're going to rewrite this action in terms of so your configuration variable now is going to be your spatial metric, and then you have the associated momenta associated to that. And plus some constraint. And the issue with this ADM formulation is that the constraints are non-polynomial. So when you have non-polynomial constraint, we don't really know how to quantize that. So at this stage, we were a bit stuck. But then Ashtekar came in 1986 and proposed a new formulation of gravity. So starting from the ADM formalism, you can do a change of variable, where now you have a tetrad, and or even here a triad, and the SU2 spin connection. Okay, so I'm going to come back on this variable. So, but what is really, so this is now your configuration variable and your conjugated momenta. And these are your constraints. And now what is interesting is that these constraints are polynomial, so we know more or less how to quantize them. So these are your variable, your phase space variable. And I just want to mention one thing here is that you have this parameter gamma, which is what we call the Barbero-Emirzi parameter. So in the 3D case, you won't see this parameter anymore. But I just want to talk a bit about it now, because in the 4D case, it can be important, in particular when we are going to mention black hole physics. Okay. So what is this Emirzi parameter? This just means that here you don't only have one couple of variables. So this is called the Ashtekar Barbero variables. But you have a family of variable, which depend on this parameter. And at the classical level, everything is fine. You can really work with all of them. But it seems that at the quantum level, this is going to give different theory. Okay, and you will see that when we're going to talk about black hole physics, this parameter is important here. So this is the first ingredient. It was to make this change of variable. And so now what is really important is that this action really looks like a SU2 Young-Mill action, so theory. So this means that all the tools that we know from Young-Mill theory can be used in the context of gravity. Okay, so here we have really a SU2 connection, which is like very similar to a SU2 Young-Mill connection. So this was the first step. Then what is the second step? The second step is, of course, about loop. Okay, here we are talking about loop quantum gravity. So what is the idea with loop? The idea with loop is that we can use loop. So let me to measure curvature. So let's look at just a loop on a flat space, on a flat surface. Okay, so now if I try to parallel transport a vector on this loop, okay, I'm going to end up with the same vector I started with. Okay, and indeed here I'm on a flat surface, so the curvature is zero. But so let's do now the same on a sphere. So now I'm on a sphere, and I'm starting with this vector. I'm going to parallel transport this vector, and you see that when I'm ending up at the same starting point, it's not the same vector anymore. So this make that this is a way to measure the curvature. And this was the initial idea of loop quantum gravity, was really to use loops to measure curvature. And the initial basis, initially, loop quantum gravity were really using as a basis some loops. Okay, so right now, the more modern description is not using loops anymore. But we will see that we still need, because we're going to work with holonomies and stuff like this, we're still using this idea to measure curvature. But so now the basis, the basic fundamental acceptation of space are described in terms of what we call a spin network. So a spin network is not a loop now, but it's a graph. So it can be open graph. Okay, and the graph has to be oriented, and it's decorated. So what is decorated here? This means that each edge of your graph is going to be labeled by SU2 here, irreducible representation. And each node is going to be labeled by an intertwiner. So an intertwiner, I'm going to come back on that a lot during the lecture, is just an invariant tensor in the tensor product of all the irreducible representation coming to this node. Okay. So, and this irreducible representation of SU2 and intertwiner are the quantum number of your theory. So what is the interpretation of this number? What can we say about this? Because if you remember, so let me just maybe emphasize on something. So here we are using a canonical quantization. So this means that we are doing first a canonical analysis. So we're doing a 3+1 splitting of spacetime. So here really what we have, when I'm talking about the basis of the kinematical hyperspace, this means that this is the basis for space. Okay, and then we will have to deal with the dynamics. How is that going to evolve? So here, this is space, and on space, you have this graph, this spin network states. But again, I was telling you that we want a theory of quantum gravity, which is a theory of quantum geometry. So where is the geometry here? Here, we just have graph with some quantum number. So where is the geometry here? So here is the interpretation. Yeah, so first, this spin network states were introduced by Carlo Rovelli and Lee Smolin, who is working here. And so with Ashteka, Carlo Lee and Ashteka are really the three people who, we give birth to like loop quantum gravity. So, where is the geometry? So now we can build geometrical operators. So for example, we have here it's just the area operator, and we can act. So I tell you that the spin network are the basis of your kinematical hyperspace. So you can act with this operator on this basis. And what you're going to see is that, so if I look just at a given edge, the associated, if now I act with an area operator on this edge, okay, what I'm going to get is to show that the spin network basis first is diagonalized, the area operator, and the eigenvalue here are going to be depend on the, can be written in terms of the decoration, the SU2 irreducible representation I have on each link. Okay, so what does it mean? This means first that area is discrete. You can show the same thing with volume. So what is the picture that we have here? This means that space now is formed by atom. Okay, and this atom of space are characterized by this quantum number. So you have the area characterizing. So each edge is going to carry a quanta of area, given by the SU2 irreducible representation, and each node is going to carry a quanta of volume. Okay, so this is kind of the picture that you have in quantum gravity, at least for space, because now we still need to solve the dynamic. So in the canonical approach, this would mean to solve the Hamiltonian constraint. So this is still an open problem, but so that's why then the spin foam model were introduced. The idea of the spin foam is to use this path integral to describe transition amplitude between spin network state of loop quantum gravity. So now you have a kind of evolution of spin network state. So I'm not, so this is a bit the picture. We're going to go back, of course, on that during the lecture. And but so what is the picture of loop quantum gravity spin foam is that you have atom of space evolving in time. Okay. So just quickly, I'm going to tell you what we're going to do in this lecture, and then Beatrice is going to talk about loop quantum cosmology for you today. So what do we want? We want to build some theory of quantum gravity. So as I said, the starting point is we need GR and quantum mechanics. So from GR, we're going to look at what are the actions we have here. And from quantum mechanics, what are the quantization approaches we can use? Of course, the action you should know from your relativity course is the Einstein-Hilbert action. As I said, we don't really know how to use at least the canonical approach on this action, so we're going to work with the first-order Palatini action written in terms of the Ashteka-Barbero variable, which are a tetrad and a connection. Then, of course, when we have such an action, we're going to see that what is really important is to do the canonical analysis and to study the symmetry and to see if we have gauge symmetry in this section. So we're going to spend some time on that issue and then perform the canonical analysis. In the canonical analysis, because we will have gauge symmetries, we're going to see that the equation of motion are going to give us constraints. So the one first part of the lecture is going to see how we can deal with constraint system and how we can perform canonical analysis, canonical quantization on a constraint system. Then, so yeah, the quantization approach we're going to use is mainly the canonical quantization by Dirac, but we're also going to talk about the path integral quantization at the end, by more introduced by Feynman. So I won't talk anymore about the perturbative approach. But we're going to first, as a toy model, before starting talking about gravity, we're going to talk about the parametrized particle. We have the same feature as gravity, mainly, many features as gravity. So it's going to be useful to do the canonical analysis on that. And then so applying canonical quantization on the first order palette injection, we're going to get loop quantum gravity. And if we do now the path integral on this same action, we're going to end up with what we call spin form model. So in this course, we will, as I said, mainly focus on 3D gravity with zero cosmological constant and the loop quantum gravity approach. So for the first two lectures, I'm going to focus on constraint system, how we deal with canonical analysis and the Dirac program for this constraint system. And then we're going to go through gravity. Okay. And as I mentioned already, we will have many guest speakers. So in particular, Laurent is going to talk at the end of the course on what we can say about string and loop quantum gravity, if we can say something, anything about that. And some other people are going to come to talk about their research, so Bianca, and but some postdoc also, Mark, and maybe additional. I still need to figure out who is coming or not. But you will have some people coming to talk about what they are doing in research in the context of loop quantum gravity. And as I said, one motivation for having a theory of quantum gravity was about resolving singularities that we have in GR. So what about the black hole singularity? So you will have more details by Hall, who is going to come during the last week to talk about black hole in the context of loop quantum gravity. And what about the Big Bang singularity? And that you will hear more about now by Beatrice. Thanks. So I let you change that. And sorry, I also need to switch.
Ah, wonderful.
Yeah. The neglection of the cosmological constant, is that an approximation, or is there a deeper reason why we neglect? I mean, like, does a cosmological constant emerge quantum gravity, or should it be taken into the quantization?
No, it's the way we consider the cosmological constant is into the as a parameter into the theory. And if we introduce, so there are several proposals to how to introduce it. But for example, if we compare to in 3D, we can compare with other approaches like Gerd-Simon theory and everything. And in this context, or even the spin foam framework. And in this context, the discussion is in terms of quantum groups as gauge group. So everything is more complicated, but it's not clear that in 4D we will need a quantum group or not, but we don't really know how to implement the constraint, the cosmological constant. The cosmological constant as a parameter is going to enter only in the Hamiltonian constraint, but then we, even in 3D, for example, then we don't know how to quantize that. So one suggestion is that maybe we should already at the kinematical level work with a quantum group. So this is one suggestion, but this is has been studied in 3D, but in 4D there is no really clear answer. So it's just that it's more complicated. So right now we haven't really, yeah, there are not so many results on this issue, but it's still it's taken as a parameter, it's not emergent. Okay, thanks.
Hi, everyone. So my name is Neve Beatrice. I am a postdoc here. Most of the time, I spend my time thinking about GR and cosmology. But I also think it's very interesting to see if there are any potential observable effects of quantum gravity. So I have also studied some loop quantum cosmology. So I'm sure you're all very familiar with this picture that everyone shows at like pretty much every colloquium. Modulo the condensed matter ones. And you know, it's a kind of a stunning picture, right? Like this picture sort of tells us how much we already know about the history of our universe. And pretty much, you know, if you think we understood what dark energy and dark matter are, we know pretty much what happened all the way up until, say, here. And then you, depending on who you ask in this building, there may be a period of inflation or something else. And that even that part is sort of fairly well understood. But before that, what happened, we don't know. Because at that regime, we know that GR breaks down. Right? So we need a theory of quantum gravity. And the question is, okay, what if we had that theory of quantum gravity? Could that affect the further evolution? Could there be some imprints of that period in our CMB? So in order to address that question, you need a theory of quantum gravity, right, to compute what you might see. And of course, we don't quite have a full theory. We have a good understanding sort of the kinematical Hilbert space in four dimensions, but not quite about the dynamics. But then, of course, well, you could say, oh, we're stuck. But we can take the approach that, you know, even in cosmology, we don't need to understand all the solutions of GR, right? We just need to understand FRLW spacetimes, so homogeneous and isotropic spacetimes, which are very special spacetimes, right? They have six symmetries. That's not a generic spacetime, right? So we just need those cosmological spacetimes and then some tiny perturbations. And it works ridiculously well. And the reason why we know it works so well is that if we look at the CMB, the fluctuations are only 10 to the power minus 5. It's kind of surprising how well perturbation theory works in this scenario. So given that it works so well in GR, why not use it when we look at quantum gravity, right? So the approach in loop quantum cosmology is to say, okay, let's use those symmetries. So we start with GR, we do the symmetry reduction. So the simplest case, you would end up with an FRLW spacetime. You could also look at, say, anisotropic spacetimes, and you'd look at Bianchi models, et cetera, et cetera. But for the sake of the argument, let me just look at the simplest one. And then we quantize it. And essentially, what you end up with is loop quantum cosmology. And now, and by I say you quantize it, you do that sort of with techniques inspired from loop quantum gravity. So what you do, you first rewrite the variables of those spacetimes in terms of the Ashkatar-Barbaro variables that Maite was talking about. And you use sort of the lesson learned from quantum gravity that there is an area gap very seriously. And then you end up with loop quantum cosmology. And now you can go calculate things and see if there are any observable effects. Now, of course, the question is, OK, that sounds pretty awesome. But is this a valid approach? Because you could have also said, OK, let's first quantize GR and, you know, obtain a full theory of loop quantum gravity that, you know, you understand everything and it works, or some other theory of quantum gravity, whatever the true theory of quantum gravity may be. Maybe it's something completely else. Maybe it's string theory. Maybe it's, I don't know, something else. But let's assume that we have that and then symmetry reduce. Would we end up with loop quantum cosmology? And the answer is, well, actually, we don't know. There are abelian gauge theories for which we know that this diagram commutes. But for non-abelian gauge theories, there are no such proofs or examples or anything like that. So whether this actually gives us the same, we don't know. So we may ask ourselves the question, OK, so maybe this is not useful at all, this approach. Maybe we should not even bother going this route because we may get something completely differently if we take the other route. And there are indeed some hints that, you know, if you go the lower way, this is not useful because it's quite difficult that if you start with a symmetry reduced version to recover space-time covariance. And this is work by Boyold and then collaborators that sort of study the hypersurface deformation algebra, which is, you know, a way of rewriting GR, that shows that generically you get anomalies if you're not careful. So if you're ever going to work in loop quantum cosmology, you should make sure you understand this argument before you dive into it. However, there are also some hints that this could actually, even though, you know, may not be, the diagram may not commute, it may still be useful. It may capture some relevant physics. So what are those arguments? Well, we have some examples for that show that if you start with sort of a more generic spacetime, so say an anisotropic model, so an anisotropic model quantized according to the loop quantum gravity techniques, and then you integrate out those anisotropies, you obtain the quantized version of the isotropic model. So that's sort of a good check. So sometimes sort of like in these simpler settings, this diagram does commute. No way. Another kind of cool check is that if you use the direct quantization of the hydrogen atom by just quantizing the electron and the proton, so you forget about all the photons. I'm ignoring infinitely many degrees of freedom in doing this. Still, I can get some physically interesting results, right? Because in the classical theory, we know that sort of the ground state energy of the electron is unbounded from below. But using this quantization, I get a finite energy. The ground state is like minus 13, roughly, electron volts, right? So you can get some physically interesting results. Of course, if you do this, with you don't think about the photons, you're going to get miss the Lamb shift and things like that. But nonetheless, you've captured some relevant physics, right? So even though maybe loop quantum cosmology is not going to be the final answer, it can give us insight into what a theory of quantum gravity may do for us and what we could potentially see. On top of that, so these are two examples in the quantum theory that show that sometimes symmetry reduced versions are not crazy to work with. They may teach you more generic lessons. There are also cases in the classical theory, in GR, that show that symmetry can be quite useful to find results. So for example, if you look at the history of singularities, initially they were found by these Russian people in these highly symmetrized settings. And then there was a long debate, people saying, well, nice you found these singularities, but you know, for generic spacetimes, they don't exist. Because you know, for our physical universe, it's not going to be perfectly homogeneous and isotropic, so let's not worry about it. But now, of course, we know by the theorems of Hawking, Penrose, Garrosh, and all those other people that singularities are much more general than just restricted to those very special spacetimes in which they were initially found. So sometimes symmetries, even if you find something in a symmetry-reduced setting, it holds much more generally. On top of that, we know from the BKL conjecture that in GR, if you approach a space-like singularity, that essentially the spatial derivatives become much less important than the time derivatives. And what that sort of tells you roughly, intuitively, that you know, two different points, they talk less and less to each other, right? Because their space-time derivatives are negligible. And they sort of become start talking less and less to each other and become asymptotically silent. Sort of each if you follow each point, it's only cares essentially about itself. And what you see is that if you follow those points in the approach to the space-like singularity, that they go through different Bianchi stages. They go through Bianchi 1 and 2s and all of those, which are exactly these simple cosmological models. And this is true for any space-like singularity. It doesn't have to be, you know, cosmological singularity. So understanding what happens, you know, in a quantum gravity regime near these singularities for cosmological spacetimes may have much more general implications for other other singularities as well. So that's why, you know, I think it's worth to study loop quantum cosmology. So what it does indeed, we start with this cosmological spacetime, then quantize it using these techniques from loop quantum gravity, and we focus sort of on these macroscopic questions. And one of the first lessons that we learn is that if you take that area gap seriously, there is a maximum energy density. So in GR, your energy density can be infinite. But in loop quantum cosmology, there's naturally maximum energy density. So that's lesson number one. And secondly, what you find is that if you look at states which have sort of a high energy density, a quantum repulsive force emerges. So this is very much similar to, say, what happens in neutron stars, right? Without quantum mechanics, neutron stars wouldn't exist. They would collapse into black holes. But because of the Fermi repulsion, these neutron stars are stable. And so similarly here, there's sort of like this quantum repulsive force. However, here, this quantum repulsive force is not a result of, you know, the quantum mechanics of matter, but it's really a result of the quantum nature of space-time. And as a result, if you are to go backwards in space, you know, and you see the universe becomes hotter and denser, at some point in GR, it would just collapse and you get a singularity. But in this case, at these high energy densities, this quantum repulsive force kicks in and you get a bounce. Now, you can sort of show this generically for crazy quantum states, right? Because in quantum mechanics, you can come up with any state you like, essentially. But this may not be very particularly useful to get insight in how this works. So what you can do is say, okay, we already know that the universe we see today seems fairly classical. So let's look at those states that are somewhat classical today and are sharply peaked around this classical state and then evolve backwards. What happens? And then you can get a very nice effective description of loop quantum cosmology. And as it turns out, it's rather simple. So what you see here is essentially, if you ignore these extra terms, just your normal Friedmann equation. But what these quantum, the quantumness of this space-time kicks in only at, you know, when the energy density is high, right? And then when the energy density becomes maximum, what you see is here that your Hubble rate vanishes, so your A dot is zero, and you get your bounce. So this is the case for, you know, an FRLW spacetime with spatially flat surfaces, but you can get effective equations also for the closed case and many other things. And what you generically find is that the singularity is avoided. So that's pretty neat. So you can see essentially, you know, if you just look at a plot, right, at late times, you see that these two lines, the LQC line and the GR line, they will agree super well, super boring. But if you go towards the past, you see that in LQC, you get a bounce. There's some minimum skill factor, which I've just normalized to one in this case, but you know, it could be any value. Whereas the GR one will continue to go to zero and give you a singularity. Now that's pretty cool. Singularities are avoided, that's nice. Now the question is, can we actually see this? And well, cosmologists have given us this wealth of information. Are there any imprints of quantum gravity in this picture? Now, the standard sort of way to analyze this data, because there's a lot of data there, is to look at or focus on the two-point function, because it's easy to analyze from a data perspective, and it's also easy to calculate for us theorists. So that's kind of nice that at least we all agree on that. So what you do is essentially, right, you start with this picture, you look at the two-point function, that's this particular line, and then you can evolve it backwards with known physics. So you go back through the matter and radiation-dominated era, and if you go back all the way to the beginning of the radiation-dominated era, what you find is that essentially your power spectrum is this almost scale-invariant power spectrum. Fairly plain and boring. And the reason why sort of inflation is such a popular model among cosmologists is that it sort of generically predicts for you this nearly scale-invariant power spectrum. So I'm going to take in this, the rest of this hook, sort of the approach that, okay, I don't know what inflation is, but let's sort of, it seems to fit the data fairly well. So I'm going to use this sort of as a framework to look at how would quantum gravity effects change inflation, and how may that change this picture. Of course, there's also other people working in loop quantum gravity and cosmology in general for alternatives to inflation, and also they get, you know, potential observable effects. But for this talk, let's keep it simple and stick to inflation. So what do usual cosmologists do? Right, so they start with their FRLW background and some scalar fields. Then they perturb it, and you right here you see all your scalar modes that you know from cosmology, your vector modes, your tensor modes. You plug them into delinearized Einstein's equations, evolve them, and then calculate the power spectrum from your gauge invariant perturbations that you combine in a particular way. Hey, Willa, that's the usual story. So how could quantum gravity change this? Well, quantum gravity, right, happens in this regime where the energy densities are really high, right? And in an FRLW background, these energy densities, the maximum energy that you can get, you can actually calculate very specifically, and it's 0.42 times the Planckian energy density. And then, you know, the corrections are relevant, say, up to like 1,000th of this maximum energy density. But inflation happens like all the way here, when, say, the energy density is roughly 10 to the power minus 12. If you work with, say, an M squared phi squared potential. Now, if you are an effective field theorist, you would say, this is like, you know, many orders of magnitude difference. Who cares? It's irrelevant. Done. So quantum gravity is completely unimportant. However, here's a following argument why it actually may be important. And it's an heuristic argument. So in cosmology, the scalar perturbations essentially, right, evolve with this wave equation. And whenever the Ricci curvature term there is small, these perturbations essentially evolve as if they're on a flat Minkowski background. So they just satisfy the flat Minkowski wave equation. And as a result, since they're evolving sort of in flat space time, they don't really interact with the background. So they don't get spontaneously excited. And they just remain, if they are in a vacuum state, they remain in a vacuum state, more or less. So all these modes in VR, they do not get excited because, as you can see, if you look at the curvature radius, essentially it's always larger. If these modes would have, if you know, these lines would have been flipped, these modes can get as excited by interacting with the background. Now the picture in loop quantum cosmology is very different, right? Because we know that the curvature is scalar. The curvature radius actually does go to a finite value. And since n actually doesn't go like that, but in this particular way, due to the quantum corrections. Right? Since the skill factor behaves differently, it doesn't go like that, but it goes like this. And on top of that, the modes don't all go to zero, because all the modes here go to zero because of the skill factor going to zero, but they go to some finite value. And now, if you look at some of these modes, right, they're still significantly smaller than this curvature radius term, so they don't get excited either by interacting with the background. But there are a bunch of modes that potentially could get excited.
Are those the small L modes that are like...
They're small L, yes.
Shit.
Yes. Okay. So these are the large modes, which in CMB, the large scales correspond to small L. Yeah. So they can get potentially excited. Now, of course, the question is, do these modes fall within the observable range, yes or no? And that sort of, well, depends on your initial conditions. But kind of the cool thing is, like you said, the relevant point is that these potentially, you know, this imprint from this quantum gravity regime has an imprint on the large scales. And on the large scales means these sort of like these earliest times. Interest of time, I'll skip the discussion of the picture. So now the question is, okay, we've understood the background, but now, of course, we need to look at perturbations. How do these perturbations propagate on this super, you know, quantum crazy background? In principle, right, they could couple to all the different quantum modes, right, that I have. But as it turns out, there are various approaches in loop quantum cosmology to study perturbations. But as it turns out, in this one particular approach, which is called the dress metric approach, effectively, these perturbations only care about this particular quantum combination of the scale factor with the background Hamiltonian, and this particular combination which gives you the sort of the time variable. And this is very non-trivial. Even like the researchers that found this result were like, we did not expect this. So it seems kind of puzzling, but then again, you know, even if you think about it, you can sort of think about this analogy with a glass of water, right? So if I am shining light, perturbations through water, I don't care about all the quantum states of the water molecules in that water. I don't need to know all the different energy levels of where the electrons are, etc. All I need to know to describe what those, you know, what the light does is the refractive index. It's pretty simple, right? So concerning these perturbations in a way that they're a little bit like light propagating through water. If you want to describe what they do, all you care about are these particular combinations. Now, the nice thing is, so that's kind of nice, right? Because then I can essentially use sort of the usual equations from cosmology, but now instead of, right, these scale factors are now these dressed scale factors, and the time is now this dressed time, these quantum states. But the cool thing is that for these sharply peaked states, the dressed scale factor is really well approximated by these quantum effective equations. So all I do to obtain the results in loop quantum cosmology for these perturbations is essentially by looking at how the perturbations change by the change in this background. And if we do that, of course, there are some, you have to choose an initial conditions for your perturbations. So the results depend a little bit on your initial conditions. But let me just show you the result for one set of initial conditions. And this is what we find. So this is the power spectrum, right, the primordial power spectrum, the power spectrum that should be nearly scale invariant if you look at standard inflation. And that's what you get, sort of the Bunge-Davis power spectrum. That is the black line on the top, which is indeed nearly scale invariant. And what we find is that in loop quantum cosmology, you actually, if you do the calculation, you get all these different blue dots. You're like, what? But if we average these blue dots, you get that red line. And the point is that that red line is, at least in this case, on the large scales, so small k, large scales, is power suppressed. And as it turns out, that actually fits the Planck data better than the Bunge-Davis one. Now, of course, it depends also, whether you would actually see it depends on how small of a k you can see. Anyway. And that depends on how much inflation happens, which again depends on your initial condition. So there could be still a way out. But if sort of the conditions are about right, there could be effects in the sky of loop quantum gravity that we've already seen in the way of power suppression that may have been predicted by loop quantum cosmology. Now, there's many questions about, or many question marks, you can say, and many things that could be improved upon, but it's a pretty cool idea. Now, you may wonder, okay, where does this like kind of oscillatory behavior come from? This is very different from the top case. And the reason why it comes about is essentially has to do with the fact that it's actually a very surprising fact. You should be puzzled by this. But if you specify initial conditions at the bounds, which some set of natural initial conditions at the bounds, which doesn't look at all like a Bunge-Davis state, but you evolve that through the quantum gravity regime all the way to the beginning of inflation, as it turns out, somehow all these states naturally look something close to a Bunge-Davis state. It's very surprising that if you can evolve like 10 to the 12 orders of magnitude from a state that doesn't look at all like a Bunge-Davis state, you naturally get something that looks close to a Bunge-Davis state, but not quite. So essentially, right, you get sort of like these modifications of the Bunge-Davis state with these alpha and betas. And if you then look at the power spectrum, which is essentially the square of these Qs, you find sort of the usual Bunch Davies one, but with these corrections. And now the oscillatory behavior comes from this term, this the angle between alpha and beta, sort of. Unfortunately, you can't really see that in the sky because we don't have a resolution that is so good that you can actually see the oscillations. So all we see is that average red power suppressed one. And the interpretation of these terms are essentially the number of particles that are produced during the pre-inflationary quantum gravity area. Now, of course, you can also look at the tensor to scalar ratio. You also get slightly different results. Interesting. The results depend on what kind of initial conditions you choose. So let me just show the conclusions. I'm sure you guys are ready for tea and coffee. So the cool thing about loop quantum cosmology is that it generically resolves singularities and it replaces the Big Bang with a big bounce. And the even cooler part is that it's potentially observable in particular on the very large scales in the CMB, and it might already explain some of the anomalies observed in the CMB, such as the power suppression anomaly. So the Planck people, they put out several papers on their anomalies. They're only 2 to 3 sigmas. So you could say, well, they're just, you know, statistical fluctuations. But, you know, if loop quantum cosmology could explain all those statistical fluctuations in one go, that would be a very compelling argument that actually these statistical fluctuations are not fluctuations, but physical effects that we actually see in the sky already. So maybe up to you to calculate these other anomalies and see what the loop quantum cosmology effects are for those. Thank you for your time. If you have any questions, you can always find me in office 432, descending. You have to get to the top, but then it's descending the number. Yeah, that's it.
Thanks.
Me what a Bunch-Davies vacuum is?
Yeah. Oh, that's fair. A Bunch-Davies vacuum is sort of the, well, in Minkowski, the natural vacuum would be the Poincaré invariant vacuum, right? And a Bunch-Davies one is sort of the same one, but then for the sitter. So the one that is invariant under the sitter. Yeah, good question. Sorry. You guys get overwhelmed with information in all the different courses, right? Any other questions? Okay. Well, you.
What's like the physical origin?
The physical origin, it really has to do with the quantum nature of space-time.
Okay.
So classically, indeed, gravity always attracts.
Yeah.
But quantum mechanically, it doesn't always do that, but only when the energy densities are extremely high. And so generically, even quantum gravity behaves just like classical gravity most of the time, right? But in only these very extreme regions does it look very different.
Is it something about an area gap when you're talking about that? Is that like you don't have enough states, or you've filled up all your states, or something like this? Not really? Okay.
If you want, you could think of it a little bit that way.
Not really, okay.
No. I think you get into other troubles if you were to, other conceptual paradoxes, if you go along that route. I like the suggestions.